Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Well, that's some very key fundamental points brought up there, but let me take some questions from the audience. While you're thinking, I'll ask a question then. I think one of the key issue in the end, and it's come up several times this morning, I mean, you know, on the one hand, you've got Jed say, well, look, it's all very well, you set up a library or whatever, run by as a social enterprise or, you know, but it still has to be, well, you've got to have health and safety, you can't have the roof falling in and that kind of thing. So he's saying on the one hand that it's still got to be monitored, it's got to be regulated. On the other hand, as you said, there is a lot of regulation and it is enough to stifle small enterprises. How do you sort of square that kind of particular circle? Because you've gone through it, or you're about to go through it.
I've been through it before.
social enterprises, I mean, you know, there's the old cliche about it's easier to set up a youth gang than a youth club, other than a youth gang than a youth club. You know, the regulation put in the way of small enterprises is often a real challenge.
Yeah.
And yet you've got to balance that against the fact, well, you know, there's still going to be some accountability and some sort of monitoring and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to what sort of enterprise are you trying to set up and why. So, you know, take the community library instance. You know, can libraries be run by communities? Well, they can be run by they can have some volunteers in there, but they do need a level of professionalism, and they do need a level of professionalism and business. So is there a mixed model that you can have? You know, I came across libraries about 6 months ago, and I never realised people were so passionate about blooming libraries. You know, so the question I would have for councils and libraries is it the library people are passionate about, or is it actually that it's a meeting space and it does something? And if it's a meeting space and it does something, can you not do something else with that space and encourage other businesses, such as Costa Coffee or, you know, somebody of that, to take ownership of that space, deal with the health and safety issues, deal with the estates issues, and allow the community group to run the book service? You know, is that another model? So I think we seem to be going down this route of saying it's either social enterprise or it's private or it's public sector. And actually, you know, there are lots of people out there that would want to join in partnership with community groups to do something. Because a coffee shop, if you can get people in the door because there's a mums and tots group or there's something else, they're going to get business. So we need to be a little bit more open-minded. But your original question about how do you get around those things, I think you've got to assess. We come across lots of organisations that they ring us up and say, we want to be a community interest company, or we want to outsource. And we normally say to them, how did you get to that decision? What did you do in order to make the assessment that that is the right model for that service? And they're not doing that.
All I would add is I don't think we get many complaints about libraries and people complaining that they couldn't get their book out. We probably wouldn't deal with it. But it's just another example for me about how the local authority has to still meet its statutory duties and responsibilities. Mm-hmm. So it is a question about whatever the appropriate health and safety framework is, etc. And because they can't passport that on, whatever, you know, however innovative and exciting, you know, the model might be, as long as that exists, it has to be properly carried out.
Okay, we'll take a question, from one of the viewers, online viewers.
Come in from South Cambridgeshire District Council. It was aimed at Jed, but perhaps you can help. Looking at services, benchmarking should be this simple. It should have the three E's. It should be 1, economic, 2, effective, and 3, efficient. Will localism provide this?
Okay. Do you want to think about that for a minute while I take another question?
We'll
take another question, then we'll add them together. The gentleman at the front.
Yeah, thank you. David Thane from Worcestershire County Council. There's an argument that says that the entrepreneurial spirit, if you like, is not embedded into local authority mindsets. So I would ask you to comment on just how far that might be true of people who want to set up social enterprises, and in percentage terms, perhaps, would you say people need passion, or a business sense, or an entrepreneurial spirit? What's the makeup of somebody or an organisation that wants to become a social enterprise, in your view, or will be?
My mantra is always, it's easy to teach business sense, it's very hard to teach passion. So you can buy business sense, you can't buy passion. So I think most people who work in the public sector went into the public sector because they wanted to do something good. You know, that's why I joined the public sector. I could have been an accountant or a lawyer. I wanted to be a nurse. Is there a balance? I think entrepreneurial-wise is sometimes people from. Sometimes they need to be helped to take risks because they don't understand what risks are involved, and all they see is terms and conditions, pension, safety. Entrepreneurialism, do you need it to set a business up? I don't know. You know, the most successful business people are the entrepreneurs, not always. You know, is Alan Sugar an entrepreneur? You know, Richard Branson, yeah, Duncan Bannatyne, you know. You listen to them all and they've all got that maverick spirit. And the key bit for me, I mean, I were laughing at home the other day because I said I've just given up my job and I'm, you know, going at the end of March. And my son, who's 24, texts me and said, I've just looked at the definition of an entrepreneur, Mum. The definition of entrepreneur is they're always in trouble. So, you know, that you've got to be able to take those risks and you've got to know that actually what's the worst thing that could possibly happen. And I don't think people in the public sector have either been exposed to that or know that they can do that. And those that have probably left. And I think that's really sad for the public sector.
But it is, I mean, it's like yourself, you left the public sector. I mean, it is too, it's a paradox that we expect somehow the public sector to be entrepreneurial, when actually, if they were entrepreneurial, they probably wouldn't be working for the public sector.
Because you get in trouble.
Yeah, because the whole point about it is you take risks if you're an entrepreneur. Yep. And you can't do that necessarily in the public sector. But I mean, being, you know, setting up a, you don't have to be Richard Branson. I mean, there's lots of self-employed plumbers and electricians, yep, who earn a very good living, and they're not Richard Branson, but they run their own businesses. And it might be, you
but
know,
they're
the
prepared
classic
to take risks.
Well, exactly. And I mean, obviously, there's a risk. You know, we all know friends and family who, yep, are self-employed or freelance or whatever. It doesn't necessarily, presumably, have to be. You don't have to be an entrepreneur. You just maybe somebody decides to go it alone or works with a couple of other people. You know, it could be that small, could it not?
It can be, but I would argue that they're equally entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
They equally,
yeah,
don't want to work. You know, most people that go self-employed, I think sometimes people just do it because they have to, because they've got no other choice. But most people who work self-employed don't do it because they want to go to work at 9 a.m, go home at 5 p.m. and get a guaranteed wage.
Okay, Jane, on that one.
Well, I feel I must just say that in my experience of sort of working in and around local government for quite a few years, there's an awful lot of initiative and, well, I think entrepreneurship, actually. I mean, people might not be motivated by the profit motive, but, you know, I think we shouldn't lose sight of that. That over, the, you know, frankly, it's what makes a lot of things happen in local authority. You know, there's never enough money, writ large at the moment. And you know, I think we've all seen some really interesting initiatives. And I mean, I won't name the council, but I worked for a council once where, you know, it was kind of they would have a go at almost anything, and some of it was balmy and some of it was fantastic. And we didn't know at the beginning which it was going to be, but, you know, that was how it was. And but it was certainly entrepreneurial. So I think there's probably something to do with the business model where we might find that it doesn't quite go as far as we might want it to. But I mean, that's not my area of expertise, but just felt that needed to.
Well, let's sort of go back as well to which is related to the original question about the three E's.
Oh, yes.
Well, I mean, one of the questions, as you know, the Localism Act, we've now got this power of general competence. Is that going to suddenly free up entrepreneurialism? Will councils be taking more risks? And will they also, that leads on to the three E's, efficiency, effectiveness, and what's the other one? Value.
Efficient, effective, and economic, I wrote down.
You know, is that going to be more part and parcel? Is that going to be encouraged? Or how will it operate in the Localism Act? I think that was the question, wasn't it?
I think we need to ask our local authority colleagues. I don't know how many local authority chief exec and leaders we've got here, but, you know, from my mind, everything we do, it's public money. You know, it's my money. I pay my tax and a blooming lot of it. You know, we all pay our taxes. So I want anybody that is spending my money to do things efficiently, effectively, and with good economics. The question is, will the localism bill free that up? I suppose it goes back to the, you know, what do you do as an individual local authority that makes efficient, effective and economic sense, and what do you do as a collective? And I think, you know, we spent some time with 8 or 9 big local authorities a few weeks ago, And the mantra there was very much about there are things we will do separately, but there's things we absolutely have to do together. Authorities a few weeks ago. And the mantra there was very much about there are things we will do separately, but there's things we absolutely have to do together. Because if we don't, then it's not going to make sense. So, will localism bill do it? Well, the general power of competence will allow people more freedom to do things, but we still need to have that common sense. There'll be some things that need to be done nationally, some things locally, some things geographically.
I mean, just to answer the question on the three E's, I mean, clearly you can't argue with the three E's, but it's a case of it ain't that simple. It's what sort of sits underneath the three E's to actually make them deliverable in proper benchmarking terms. And for me, the effective one is the one that's probably the most interesting because, you know, if effective means, you know, does what it should do, does what it says on the tin, how do we decide, you know, what effectiveness is? And how do we, just to link it back to, you know, my central premise and this issue of accountability, how do we keep on knowing that effective is what service users want, local communities want, etc. So I'm not sure I can say much more about than that, really, on that point. Power of general competence, absolutely welcome it. I mean, I think, you know, hopefully it will free up local authorities to just do, you know, more of the good stuff that they have done in the past and probably wanted to do more of.
Okay, now we've got a couple more questions. Paul at the back, and there's another gentleman at the back, and then we'll take three together, I think.
Stand up, okay. Hi there. I just wanted to make a point about, I think it was Jane's second last point, about innovation and entrepreneurship. You know, and we're currently doing a study with De Montfort University at present into this, you know, and looking at examples across local government of where this is taking place. And I think it's easy to fall into this myth about local governments all monolithic and bureaucratic and all that, when actually the last 28 years when I've been in local government, I've seen numerous examples of local authorities in terms of efficiency, cutting through bureaucracy in terms of service redesign, stripping out 25% of costs at times. You know, some of the things that Jed's probably been touching on today as well, in terms of commercialisation strategies round about ensuring that there's a wider spread of overheads through providing a wider range of services to people. And then looking at innovation over the last 18 months or so, the initiatives that have been undertaken round about the environmental agenda, round about solar, round about biomass, round about wind, the things that local authorities have done there, unfortunately, the feed-in tariff debate the last few weeks has impacted on that slightly, but I'm sure local authorities will continue to go on and look at that agenda and exploit it, both in terms of the social and environmental benefits that come from that, but also in terms of the financial benefits that can get returned to authorities. So I just wanted to have a pop at that myth that can build up about, you know, bureaucratic, monolithic, there's no innovation, no entrepreneurship in local government. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. And there's a gentleman at the back as well, I think the other side of the... Is there somebody at the back there? No? Is it, okay, sorry, the lady there, then at the back.
Thank you. Teresa Lafort, OPAL, Older People's Advocacy Alliance UK. Well, I've got a couple of questions. One was to Ged, but he's gone now. The other one was to Jane about the process of taking out a complaint. It's very bureaucratic and people don't know how to access the system. And I just feel sometimes we're being deprived of our rights in doing that. And secondly, you talked about children and education and young people, but I don't think any sort of legislation or activity regards older people having a right to education and learning in later life. That always seems to be thrown out with bathwater, if you like. And also about the accountability of private firms, what will happen if they do have joint services, and who will be accountable to the clients, to the consumers, to everybody. Because they'll say it's a business and they don't have to be accountable.
Okay, thank you very much. And I'll take one last question at the front and then I think we'll go back to the panel for the last time.
I'm Henry Peterson, an independent consultant. It's a question for Danielle. If you look at a country like Italy, where a lot of the social care is provided through mutuals and cooperatives, I mean, what is the big difference between them and us? Is it cultural? Is it the effect of religion over the centuries? Or is it that they have a statutory framework that makes it much easier to set up mutuals and enterprises, whereas we have a collection of sort of 19th century laws on industrial and provident friendly societies and statutory framework, which isn't particularly simple for people to work through.
Okay, well, let's start with that question first, Danielle.
The easy one. Before we do that, can I just go back and say my point about entrepreneurialism isn't that there isn't entrepreneurialism in the public sector, because I equally work with some fantastic fire and rescue services, health services, etc., where they're absolutely the same as local authorities entrepreneurial. Back to Italy. Why do we not do it over here? I don't know. Culturally, you know, are we a less risk-averse population? Is it because things get funded through the public sector, therefore people work in the public sector and it's bigger? I don't know. Is it laws? You know, I know setting up a company, I don't know if you've ever tried to set up a company, but I tried to register a company on Saturday afternoon this week because it's the only time I had to do it. And Companies House closes at 5 o'clock on Friday and it opens again on Monday morning at 9 a.m. It's a web-based service. Why does it need to be open? So is it that we do put constraints in place? I don't know. Be interested if you do know about Italy and what Italy does, then, you know. But Italy's, you know, equally in the same trouble as we're in, probably a little bit more at the moment. Does it work?
Sounds like there could be a study tour, perhaps.
Mm. Yeah, I'd rather have a go at doing something than study it. But if somebody wants to study it, feel free.
Social capital, if you look at the social capital literature, I think that all was Italian, wasn't it? You know,
Just while we're on you, Danielle, did you want to pick up any of the other points? I know there's a very specific one for Jane, but mm-hmm. Any other points or what Paul made or anything? No. Okay. Jane?
Yeah, well, I completely take on the chin the point about people not knowing how to complain, and there's a lot more that we need to do and will do, and we'll start by talking to you after this, because that was really part of the point I was trying to make, that it is complicated and we need to make it much simpler to access. I mean, I hope the Local Government Ombudsman has done its bit to make it easy for people to know how to engage with us, but if we haven't, I need to know about it. But I do take the wider point that it is not easy to wend your way through to complain at any level, and indeed to get to the Ombudsman. So all I can say is I agree, and we must do better. On the right to education later life, I'm not sure I can help, but I also agree with that. I think it's a good thing, and I'm looking forward to my next degree. And finally, on private firms, that really, in terms of adult social care, that has changed as a result of our new jurisdiction. So since October 2010, anybody who is receiving care in a private care and not got satisfaction can come through to us. That was the reason for doing it, so that we cover the whole spectrum. And again, can only apologise if that message hasn't got through. How can I put this diplomatically? You'll be aware that there are Treasury spending controls on at the moment, which make it difficult for money to be spent on promotional activity. But that's an excuse, and I'll just leave it there.
Okay. Well, I think at that note, it's 1 o'clock. Thank you very much, Danielle and Jane. Thank you all. We're going to break for lunch. There are workshops after lunch, and then we'll be back here. And do please stay to the end, because we've got a very good lineup of speakers for the last session, which will start at 3:10 and carry on to 4:30. Otherwise, break for lunch for an hour, and then your workshop. So thank you all very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.